Hello. Welcome to The Plot Thickens with me, Ellie Griffiths. You might know me as the author of the Dr. Ruth Galloway books and the Brighton Mysteries. This is a podcast that takes you behind the scenes of crime writing, from what it's really like to be a published author to the intricacies of our research and just how we think up those killer twists. Each episode, I'm welcoming an expert guest to lift the curtain on everything you want to know about the world of crime fiction. For those of you who've read my books, there'll be lots of behind-the-scenes details on the characters, setting and history. But if you haven't come to them yet, we'll be sure to flag up any spoilers, and there'll still be plenty to enjoy. Hello. Today I'm delighted to welcome a guest who's had not one, not two, but three stellar careers. Graham Bartlett was Divisional Police Commander for Brighton and Hove. After retiring at what seemed to me a very young age, he became an advisor to authors like Peter James, William Shaw, Dorothy Coombson and me. Now he's a best-selling author. His first novel, Bad for Good, won the Crime Fiction Lovers Editors Award and was shortlisted for the Crime Fest Debut Novel Award. The latest book is the terrific and quite terrifying City on Fire, set in Brighton, and it's the third book to feature Chief Superintendent Joe Howe. Graham, welcome.
Thank you very much, Ellie. Thanks for inviting me.
It's lovely to have you here. I often talk to writers about how they came into writing, and they often say that writing was the only thing they wanted to do. But I'm assuming your ambition, which was fully realised, was to be a police officer. So when did you first get involved or interested in writing?
Well, I am the extreme of a late starter in terms of writing. I had no notion of being a writer at all. As you say, my career was in the police, and I enjoyed that for 30 years. And it was right at the end of the career. I think I just retired from the police at a very young age, as you said, when I was approached by a good friend of mine and a person that people will know, Peter James, who I'd helped on his crime novels. And he wanted to write, or he'd been asked to write, a non-fiction about what life was really like policing Brighton and Hove. And he rightly said, well, I haven't really got the experience or the authenticity to do that. So can we co-write it? It's the first time anyone had ever suggested to me writing a book. So I thought, well, there's an opportunity. So I took it and we worked together, and I think it was quite a hard slog for him, getting my writing style whipped into shape. And Death Comes Knocking was the outcome 3 years later. And I've not looked back. It's been an absolute blessing to have that opportunity in the career that followed.
Death Comes Knocking is a really terrific read about policing Brighton and Hove. And say a little bit about that book. And what was your writing process with Peter?
So what the book does, the book tells of real life stories or themes. So Death Comes Knocking is actually was taken from a chapter title about giving death messages. But it's stories and themes that I've been involved in or been closely associated with that link in with the Roy Grace novel. So there's lots of kind of read across into things that Grace has done or things that have happened in the Roy Grace novels. And it's kind of chronological. So we go almost from it starts with a police shooting at the beginning of my career, and how I kind of got involved in the hunt for the shooting of the police officer, right the way through to the things that I did as the divisional commander, like reducing drugs deaths and making protests more peaceful and that sort of thing. Some of the more strategic things that I was dealing with. My writing process with Peter. Well, Peter's an absolute creature of habit. So he's a 1,000 words a day man, every day. Bar Sunday, you know, so he kind of drilled that into me. It has waned a little bit, but don't tell him I said that. But the way we did this book was I would write a chapter, send him a chapter, and he would come back with a fabulous feedback sandwich with most of the sandwich being in the middle, which was the actual feedback.
So feedback sandwiches, he starts with something good.
Yes,
and
yes.
Then has a, yeah.
Yeah, nice font, Graham. and thanks for the lovely email you sent, however. But a lot of it was about voice, and I didn't really know much about voice. My writing had always been business writing for policing, you know, with statements or reports, or so very kind of factual, everything set out, no room for nuance or misinterpretation. That's how police have to write. And of course, you know, as you know, that's the opposite for commercial writing. You need to leave the reader to work things out for themselves or in inference. And so in the end, well, he basically, I think he was like losing patience with me in the end. And he said, why don't you just go and free write a a foreword that we'll use. Just describe what it's like to walk into Brighton, for coming off the train at Brighton Station, and walk down and just write it as you see it. So I did that, and it took me about a couple of hours to do that, because I literally just kind of put myself in the picture, didn't worry too much about it, and I sent it to him. And he was on the phone within about half an hour. He said, "That's it. That's the voice that you need to be writing in." I went, "Great, great." He cracked it. He went, "Yeah, now go back and rewrite everything that you've already written." So that was it. And that development sort of continued throughout that book and into the next book, Babes in the Wood. And he still helps me today with, you know, I'll send completed drafts to him, and, you know, he'll get feedback from him.
He has said that he always knew that you were a very good writer. I've heard him say that from the beginning.
Well, he's very kind, and he had a lot to do with it.
And Babes in the Wood is, say a little bit about that. That's about a terrible real-life murder case, wasn't it?
Yeah, so Babes in the Wood tells the story of two little girls, Nicola Fellows and Karen Hadaway, who were snatched and murdered in Brighton, in a park in Brighton, in 1986. And it follows, obviously, the family's devastation and the grief, And the arrest and prosecution the following year of a man called Russell Bishop. So Russell Bishop was acquitted of those murders. He then obviously was released from court when he was acquitted, and he went on to snatch and almost kill another, even younger girl from another council estate in Brighton, and I worked on that second investigation. And he received life imprisonment for that. But there was never any doubt in anybody's mind that he had killed these two little girls. So what Babes in the Wood does is it takes the reader through what happened at the time, and then what needed to happen to re-prosecute him in 2018. And it required a significant change in the law, because up until 2005, that if you'd been acquitted of a crime, you could stand on the steps of New Scotland Yard and admit it to the world. You could never be re-prosecuted for it. That changed. So that was one thing. And also the forensic, the sensitivity of forensic processes changed as well. So there were kind of two things that needed to happen, and that they needed to be at the right stage for the police to then go back and seek a quashing of the acquittal, so he could be re-prosecuted. And he was convicted of both murders. In fact, 31 years to the day that he was acquitted of them previously. And then we've just actually published an updated version, because his girlfriend, who'd lied in the original trial, was prosecuted and convicted and jailed for perjury. So I've then sort of closed the story with that bit. So that's come out this year.
I've read the book, and it's an amazing read, and very, very interesting about the way forensics are dealt with, because there's a jumper that plays a really key role in the story, isn't it?
And yeah, it's this blue jumper. We call it the Pinto jumper. That was the brand name Pinto. And it was literally found discarded by an engineer who was working on an electricity substation. And he knew of all the police activity. So he thought, oh, I better hand that in. And it was quite some way from where the bodies were found. So it was handed into the police, and it became central to it. You know, people started to kind of link it with clothing that Bishop had been seen wearing. So it was forensically tested. Bear in mind, in 1986, there was no DNA processes to test it. So
that was really interesting to read that in the book.
Yeah.
That really, the fact that it was kept in such good condition really helped.
Well, absolutely,
it?
Yeah. And the way that the scientists had taken what they call tapings, where they apply adhesive tape and then seal it on acetate, they were kind of little capsules of evidence. So they were, all of this stuff that came off the jumper 30 years later was shown to contain Bishop's DNA. And it was, you know, it was an incredible, incredible find. But because of the difficulties that have beset the case right from the start, no one was counting the chickens until the jury returned with a guilty verdict in the Old Bailey.
And what's that like as a police officer, where you really do know that somebody has committed the crime? You said there wasn't much doubt, and you see them get away with it, and then to see them convicted. What was that like? That must have been so emotional.
Yeah, it really is emotional. I mean, you accept in sort of less serious cases that, you know, that you've done your bit, you've investigated the crime, you've presented the evidence in the best possible way to the Crown Prosecution Service, who've then prosecuted it, and it's a matter for the jury as to whether or not they're sure of that person's guilt. But on a case like this, I mean, it was sickening enough when he was acquitted because everybody knew that he was guilty. But imagine what it was like when he went and basically kidnapped and tried to do the very self same thing to a 7-year-old girl on a cold February Sunday night, you know, and everything about the case just came into sharp focus because we just felt, well, you know, had the jury been allowed to make the right decision, and I don't blame the jury for the decision they made in 1987 because there were reasons for that which are in the book, had they been allowed to make the right decision, that little girl would never have met Bishop, and her life would have been so much different.
Yeah, so terrible, and so terrible to the families to whom the book's dedicated, isn't it? I mean, just so awful. So, Graham, was fiction a bit of a relief? How did you come to going from co-writing these incredibly detailed non-fiction books to writing fiction?
Well, I had an idea for a novel in my mind, but I've like many of us, I suffer from incredible imposter syndrome. So I was thinking, well, I couldn't write a novel. It's all very well writing nonfiction because, you know, you've got the facts here and you just have to kind of write it well. But I couldn't make it out. So I sort of just, you know, faffed around with it for a little bit when I was writing Babes in the Wood. And then I spoke to Peter and just said, look, you know, here's an idea for a novel. You know, I want to write it on my own, you know, would you be, you know, what do you think? And he said, oh, absolutely a great idea. And the I mean, again, that was a very hard process because with nonfiction, you've got your characters are already there. Your world is already there.
The timeline,
the story, it's all there. You just got to write it well, as if that's easy.
Just
the writing bit. So I kind of realised that, you know, that whilst I had the story, so the premise for Bad for Good, which was my debut novel, was what happens when police cuts become so severe that vigilantism starts taking over as the crime control method of choice in Brighton. I based it in Brighton because I was seeing something very close to that, observing my former colleagues trying to kind of basically hold back the tide of crime and disorder and everything else that police brings with it. So I was thinking, how, you know, what if it got even worse? And so I wanted to tell it through the eyes of a very senior officer because I was a very senior officer, and my impression of the way people of chief superintendent rank or superintendent rank are portrayed in crime fiction or on TV is that they're kind of bumbling, self-interested, operationally ignorant, ambitious idiots, and I was none of those things. I'll let others judge whether I was, but so I thought. Well, but I knew that the politics of when you were a divisional commander, you have two gods. The first god is the chief constable, the head of the police, the head of the organisation. You're accountable to them, but the other one is the place itself, usually kind of focused through the council. But it's about, you know, I was Brighton and Hove divisional commander, and you know, you live in the city,
you know
it well. It's a very diverse city. It's very political. It has a lot of activism in there, a lot of poverty, a lot of wealth, huge nighttime economy, sporting challenges, got marathon, football, cricket, all of that. So there's so much in there, and huge crime issues like drugs and burglary and safeguard, you know, child abuse and that sort of thing, and all of that comes through the external stuff comes through the chief superintendent. So you have to kind of deal with that. You have to absorb and then translate that into operational policing, and it brings huge and fascinating challenges. So I wanted to show that. So I deliberately had my character as the chief superintendent, so you could see all of those pressures and how she, Jo Howe, kind of, you know, how she translated that into policing, and then the challenges that came back. And I mean, obviously, there's a ridiculous body count in Bad for Good. You know, we'd hope that would never happen, but You know, that's the thing about crime fiction. You take things to extremes. But you know, I wanted to show a very credible picture of what could happen. And all my novels are kind of what, you know, what happens when the political or social situation gets even worse and what could happen on the streets and in relation to crime.
And it was very fascinating as a reader to read about somebody at that level, because as you say, people, crime writers normally go for a slightly lower rank. I know that you've said that quite often crime writers should go a rank lower, because quite often we have the DI going round door to door and it should maybe be the DS or something. And I have to say, my fault for making Nelson a DCI in the first place.
He's a very good DCI. I'd have him as one of my DCIs.
Thank you very much. That's one of the best compliments Nelson's ever had. But that was very fascinating. But tell us a little bit about Jo, because I met her, because I read quite an early draft of Bad for Good and loved it. But she changed a bit, didn't she, in the process? Or maybe you made her a bit more central?
Yeah, I mean, Jo was always meant to be central, but I don't think she was strong enough. So I obviously, Jo is a woman and I'm not a woman. And so I know what it's like to become a senior officer and hold that rank as a white straight man, and frankly the pathway to that is designed around people like me. So I needed to find out what it's like for a woman. So I spoke to a lot of former women officers who kind of advised me very much on that. So Jo starts off in Bad for Good as a detective superintendent, and she's called out to the murder of the then chief superintendent's son. And it just so happens that she and the chief superintendent and her had a brief affair back in the day.
And he's so a footballer, isn't he?
The son's a footballer, yes. Yeah. He's just won his first professional contract with Brighton and Hove Albion, and he's murdered on the way home. He's celebrating, he's telling all his mates. He's a bit gobby. He's a bit kind of, you know, he's ruffling his feathers, and you know, he's showing his feathers and that. And he's murdered, and she's called out to the body, and then the chief superintendent, Phil, basically, you know, reacts probably as any father would. You know, he is absolutely devastated, but also starts to become really difficult in the organisation, because he's been battling the cuts for a long time, saying this was always going to happen. It's happened to my son now. So, long story short, he's sidelined by the force because he's become a bit of a problem. And she reluctantly, she never asked for it, becomes the divisional commander. So she's kind of got huge, like I talked about imposter syndrome a moment ago. She's got huge imposter syndrome. She's thinking, well, I shouldn't even be here. Her deputy agrees, you know, her new deputy agrees with her. So she's kind of, she's battling to find her feet as the boss of the of Brighton and Hove, while still trying to catch Harry Cook's killer. And it kind of, in relation to her, it's almost like you're following her growth really in that role, because she doesn't think she can do it. She doesn't, you know, she thinks they made a mistake putting her in there. But then she realizes that, you know, she brings a difference, and she's very strong. She's very self-effacing, but she's very strong in a quiet way. And she will deal with things in a quiet way. And as the books go on, I mean, I expose her to some horrendous trauma going through, if so much so that in the latest one, City on Fire, which is out in March, I had to see a psychologist, not for me, but for Jo, because I wanted to go, well, okay, well, I've put Jo through some horrendous things, and what would she be like now? How would she be behaving in the workplace? What would she be like with her family? And Philippa East and Chris Merritt, who are both crime writers,
yes,
and clinical psychologists, helped me hugely on that. So Jo's kind of grown into this quietly confident, but also, you know, still has the imposter syndrome, strong leader who's become a bit of a control freak, because over the books she's realised she can't trust anyone around her. Well, there's a couple of people that she can trust, but she can't trust any of her bosses, and she, you know, she can't trust those other people from elsewhere in the city. So she has to take control over things, and she goes a bit too far.
It's a terrific read, City on Fire. Very scary in places, I thought. But also I love the fact that you showed the effect that their work has on Jo, because you think of people like Poirot and Marple. They go through all that, but it doesn't seem to really affect them that much. I know they're not police officers, but I like to see that. I like to see the effect that the work has on people.
And I think anyone that's been in the police for that period of time at an operational level does bear the scars. I mean, I bear the scars of policing. You know, I'm not nowhere. You know, some people have, you know, really serious mental health problems. I'm lucky not to have that. But there are things that get to you, and you can't shift. And Joe has them in spades. Bless her.
Yes, it's, as I say, it's an absolutely terrific read and set in Brighton and, as I say, terrifying in places. So, Graham, you're carrying on writing and you're also advising various writers. And I know Leslie Thompson and I ran a crime writing certificate at West Dean, and you come in on the last day and there's police tape across the door and there's the shape of a body on the floor and you say, now we have to solve the crime. I mean, do you enjoy teaching? You're such a great teacher.
I love it. I love it because I think because I'm a writer as well, I'm able to bring my policing knowledge and my newfound writing knowledge to it. So I can kind of empathise with people that I'm teaching, and I run online courses as well, and because I kind of know what the writers want, and that what they don't want is they don't want chapter and verse, they don't want a textbook of policing, they don't want a masterclass in how to investigate a murder, they want to know how to write a murder, you know, that's what they need to do. But I like to do the fun things as well. So on the crime certificate, I love the bit where I set you and Leslie up and interview you as suspects, and I mean, ham acting is just doesn't do it justice. But we have a bit of fun with it, don't we?
We really do. But what surprised me, Graham, actually, was how frightening it was, because you set it up, and it's partly to teach our students how to write dialogue and how to do an interview scene. So Leslie and I are both suspects in this murder, and you interview us. And I remember the first time Leslie was super cool. She was like, "Yeah, well, whatever." And I confessed in 5 seconds. So you broke me. But it was interesting how frightening it was. You're a friend of mine, you're a very pleasant, soft-spoken person, yet it was frightening being interviewed by you, because you have this lovely, soft-spoken way, and then you say things like, "What? Are you sure? How could that be right?" I mean, do you bring that into your books? That?
Oh yeah, 100%, 100%. I always, my whole career, because I joined when I was 18, and I looked like a kid. And I used
what
to
was
get
your
people,
nickname again?
Well, they used to call me the boy and Mowgli, because I was the man cub. But then I used to walk around the streets of Bognor where I did my probation. People used to say, "Oh, does your mum know you're out?" and all that. So I knew that I was never going to be able to fight my way out of situations. Not that I'd want to. So I was used to kind of talking and using my, you know, using my personality. So, and it went right the way through my career. So that kind of softly spoken bit is about just kind of just making people feel really uncomfortable without the shouty bit. I mean, I did an exercise. Remember in that one class, I did an exercise of a briefing where somebody had not done what they should have
done.
You
were very frightening, Graham, without ever raising your voice.
Didn't raise my voice once, did I? It was sort of like, okay, we asked you yesterday to do that, didn't we? Do you remember that? Because everyone else seems to remember their actions. Do you remember that? And this poor, I can't remember the woman's name, but poor woman, she was going, "Yeah, I mean, so there must be a really good reason why you haven't done it and everybody else." And I just, lots of silences, lots of very, very pointed questions. And she afterwards, she was shaking.
She did. She said she was quite traumatised.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, it was all in good fun and part of the course. But it was frightening. And I think it was really interesting for writers to see that. And the other thing that I think you said about interviews is that there should be no threats, no promises and no lies.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, which surprises people, because you quite often you'll see on TV, particularly, and in, you know, in true life American documentaries where they can do some of those things. But in the UK, no threats, no promises, no lies, because that any of those would basically exclude an interview from evidence, and you've lost the whole interview then. So, but you work around it. You know, you professional interviewers work around that, and they, you know, they abide by that, but they find other ways to put pressure on.
I'm sure we can all think of televised police interviews that have broken those rules. Does it annoy you when you watch that on television? Are you able to rise above it and just enjoy the drama?
I would like to say that I'm able to rise above it. My wife and my adult children say that I cannot. And they will say that I've absolutely no ability to do that at all. And it does irk me, because I think there are some great dramas out there that can that were they to speak to somebody like me, it doesn't have to be me, but somebody like me who understands story and understands policing, they would be able to have the authenticity that I think viewers and readers are entitled to. They deserve it, while still keeping the drama. You know, yes. I think some TV writers and some novelists, they think it's an either or. You know, you can either have it authentic, you can either have your policing authentic, or you can have it dramatic, and that's absolutely not the case. And your books show that. You know, your books are authentic. That they're not chapter and verse, because no one wants that, and hopefully mine are the same.
No, well, thank you for saying that. But I know actually it's true that sometimes sometimes the reality is better and more dramatic. And I can think of an example in my own books. I'm trying to remember which one it was. I think it's The Nighthawks, where there's an armed siege. They bring in armed officers. And I asked you to help me with the scene. And I'd had Nelson sort of being in command of it. And you said, no, absolutely not. It's a different... It's a different unit, and somebody else would be in charge. And what's more, the commander would be not at the scene. They'd be over the phone. They'd be giving. And that was so much better scene, because Nelson was frustrated that he wasn't. And that just made it a lot better.
Yeah. And it is incredible. I mean, I've been in that situation, and it's incredibly frustrating. Even though you know that the people, you know, carrying the guns are better trained, better equipped, and do this every day, you know, you're sitting there thinking, oh, do they know what they're doing? You know, I'm not. Would I have done it that way? And there's nothing you can do about it, because the policy says you cannot be involved in that if you're like the senior investigating officer, as Nelson would be. But so that inner tension, it creates incredible drama. And you know, most crime fiction, most really good crime fiction is character based. And you know, so if you can get in Nelson's head, rather than have him sort of kicking doors down and, you know, pointing guns at people, which he would never do, but if you have this kind of, do they know what they're doing? What are they doing? What's going on? And not being able to that, I think that's far more dramatic.
It was far more dramatic, I must say. And I think that is an example where the reality is more dramatic and better. And you're right about things being character-based. I know you've often said to me very kindly, you know, maybe that's not strictly how it should be done, but that is how Nelson would have done it. And I think as a writer, that's what makes you such a great advisor, because you sort of go with the character.
Yeah, and I do that in my own books. I mean, there's lots of things in City on Fire where, you know, what one chief superintendent wouldn't do what Joe's doing. But because we know Joe now, and we know what kind of person she is and what presses her buttons, you know, hopefully the reader will believe, yeah, well, that's kind of Joe. There's a scene, I'm not going to spoil anything, but the scene at the end of Force of Hate, where it's completely, you know, what she does is completely reckless. But because we know Joe and we know that, you know, what's happened to her in the lead up to that, hopefully it's authentic. So it's really important, like, you know, when you ask me to advise on things that Nelson's dealing with, for me to understand the character.
Yeah.
Because you think, yeah, Nelson would do that, because he's a bit like that. You know, he's not quite by the rules. You know, he'll push the envelope a little bit, but so it's really important that the advice I give to writers is consistent with. I always say that the story and the characters are king, because you know the procedure cannot damage the story or weaken the characters. So the procedure just shores them up. So you kind of work with the characters to give them the best authentic outcome that you can.
When you first presented Bad for Good to your agent or editor, were there some things that they said that kind of you had to change, even though they were authentic, they didn't work in a story, were there?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There was one character in a very early draft that I presented to, I changed agents partway through, but to my previous agent, and she said... she said that you've got to tone that character down. You've really got to tone that character down. That no one will believe they're quite so bombastic and quite so arrogant. And I said, do you know what? I've actually based that on somebody. I've based that on somebody that I know. And she said, yeah, but it just... I said, but it's true.
You've already toned it down.
Yeah, I had. But I did follow her lead in the end. And the other one was about the number of people. The number of people it takes to investigate a murder. And it was it's the same agent. And you know, when I went to my new agent, I think most of the creases have been ironed out. But she said, you've got to cut down your police cast. It's too big. It's too confusing. You've got so many police officers involved. I said, yeah, but that's what it takes to investigate a murder. you know, you've got to have like all these people, all these, and I sort of listed off all these roles. She said, "Graham, no one cares. They just need to focus in on a few." She said, "Can you double hat some of them? Give them two roles." So I did that in the end. I, you know, because at the end of the day, it's not about writing a textbook or a how to do manual. It's about writing gripping crime fiction that people are not going to be able to put down at night.
And able to follow. I must admit, that's one of the things that struck me when I found out more about real policing. It's a massive team, isn't it? And it's also civilian officers.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
I mean, how many would there be on a murder investigation?
Well, in the early days, you could easily have 15 to 20 people involved in a I'm going to say basic murder, but in a not very complicated murder investigation. And yes, civilian officers would be part of that these days. You know, the most of the experience in major crime comes from civilian officers, because they're retired officers that have come back as investigators. And all they can't do, they can't arrest people, they can't use force, and they can't affect entry to
they're really
premises.
Important, aren't they?
They're really important. And, you know, the younger warranted officers learn a lot from them, because they've been around the block a few times, these people.
And it is really interesting, the work that they do. But I suppose one of the things that we learn sort of as writers is you've got to maybe have like six key main characters. Isabel Gray, who's a brilliant crime writer, she used to write for Midsummer Murders.
Right.
And she said that at the end of Midsummer Murders, you've got to have six people still alive
okay.
who could have done it. And I always try and bear that in mind.
Only six. I need to go back and rewrite
kill
some
a few
of
people. Yeah, off. But yeah. I think there is, I think in your books, you do give the impression of the big team, but it's the people that we know, you've sort of honed in on the key members of the team.
Yeah, and I've learned that over writing the three books. In Force of Hate, I was far more focused on there's three kind of main police characters that go right the way through. There's Joe, her deputy Gary, and Bob the DI. So they go right. So I've kind of learned to do that, and more so in City on Fire, which was tricky with City on Fire, because City on Fire is actually based on a real operation that I ran for a number of years in Brighton around trying to reduce drugs deaths and drugs offending. So there was lots more people involved in that. But again, I had to, no one cares, no, just keep it focus. So I had to do that.
It's a terrific read. So you've written now three books about Chief Super Joe. What's next? What's next in the pipeline?
So I can't go into too much detail because I'm still writing it. but I'm trying my hand at something a little bit different. Still crime, but less procedural and more expansive in terms of it's kind of the three books are based in Brighton and Hove, so this has got more of an international feel, and it's kind of about organised crime and about infiltration of organised crime and drugs and 3D printed guns and all this sort of it's quite a, my agent said write big, and I didn't really understand what he meant by that, so I just had lots of countries involved, but actually that was very much, you know, show it's around drug trafficking, but it's about organised crime and the people involved, and, you know, again, very character led. But well, hopefully it will be. Yeah.
I love those big sort of thriller type books, and I was saying to you earlier on, I think maybe we're just at the point where people want to read that. You know, there's been a bit of nostalgia for kind of old fashioned. So-called cosy crime. I think there's also nostalgia for books like sort of Neville Shute's thrillers, you know, where you travel off and go to different places. So that sounds great.
Yeah, well, I hope so. And it is definitely not cosy.
No, it sounds like it's not cosy.
But it's, again, it's, you know, it's authentic. And I've had to speak to, lots of people come to me about policing. And I've had to go to lots of people about things that I want to include in my books. And, you know, I was with someone actually last night talking to them about drug trafficking and enforcement and that sort of thing, and things that I just needed to brush up on just so I can get it right.
Because you, I know you run online courses, which I absolutely recommend to any crime writer out there. They're brilliant, and Graham brings in lots of experts. But when you bring in your espionage expert, is it true that you don't know their real name or?
Oh, the undercover officer.
The undercover officer.
Well, I do know.
Oh, okay.
But
yes.
For years, I didn't know his real name. I just, we arranged to meet. We actually met in Brighton. He was down this way, and he, I'd only ever seen him in shadows on Zoom calls because he was even a bit nervous about meeting me. So when I walked into this hotel on Brighton Seafront to meet him, I suddenly realised, I don't know who I'm looking for. And I didn't even know his real name. And then luckily he kind of clocked that because I was looking around a bit vacant and he said, oh, Graham. And
he knew you, obviously.
He knew me. So we went and that was that. It was bizarre. We'd chat all the time, but I didn't really know him. And it was only at that point he could trust me. Because he's worked under, he's infiltrated terrorist groups and, you know, international organised crime groups here and abroad. You know, he's a very, very brave man, but obviously has to be very careful about people that know who he is. So I've got a surveillance course coming up, an online course, and he'll be on it. And I tell people that you won't see his face, but you're not missing anything.
Very charming. I tell him
he's got a face for radio.
Really fascinating course, though, that sounds. So, Graham, you're a big part of the crime writer community now. Of course, I think you already knew a lot of people through your advisory work, but you go to festivals and things like that. What is the crime writing community like compared to the policing community?
It is so supportive. You know,
it is supportive.
It really, and given that, you know, we all want readers to spend their £10 on our books, there's a real lack of rivalry and competition amongst the vast, vast majority. I haven't met anybody that's trying to get the edge over anybody else. And it's so supportive. I mean, you know, I'm going to embarrass you. People like you, you know, you've been amazing to me, you know, as an emerging Brighton crime writer. You know, you've helped me. You've read manuscripts. You give me advice. You've brought me on podcasts and you know, so many other people are like that. I think there is something very collegiate about the crime writing community. I think because it's a lonely task, because we're all sat in our offices, you know, typing away, that it's nice to be able to share the tensions and the expertise and the advice and the woes with each other. And I've, you know, it's a wonderful community to have found myself in.
It is very collegiate, that's true, and thank you very much for what you said. But it's true, isn't it? Whereas writers have helped me, like, say, Val McDermott and Peter's been very generous as well, and there's nothing really in it for them to help a new writer, but they do, because I think we all are excited to see, as you are, you know, a great new writer on the block. So, Graham, thank you very much for coming onto my podcast
today. Thank you for inviting me. It's been an absolute joy.
Lots of luck with City on Fire, which is out in March, and with whatever comes next.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to The Plot Thickens. In the next episode, I'll be talking to Jane McDowell, who is the voice of Ruth Galloway on the audiobooks. So don't forget to subscribe. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave a rating or review, or better still, tell a friend about it. You can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Ellie Griffiths. The Last Word, my new standalone novel, is available to read or listen now from all major retailers. And Ruth Galloway will be returning in a very exciting collection of short stories called The Man in Black, coming this June. The Man in Black is available to pre-order now from all major retailers. This podcast is produced by Dan Jones at Carmelite Studios for Quercus Books. The executive producer is Katie Blott.